news about trauma is that pretty much nobody gets through life without experiencing it. A natural disaster, a serious accident, violence and abuse and grief in all their many forms. It feels strange to mention any good news about trauma, but there is some. Its effects are not necessarily permanent. And when we're seeking treatment for trauma, it's useful to recognize the ways that it damages both physical and mental health. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. James S. Gordon is founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and clinical professor at Georgetown Medical School. His work has drawn on a deep knowledge of the way our bodies react to extreme stress in order to help people whose brains get stuck in stress mode long after the immediate danger has passed. He explains this in his new book, The Transformation: Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you, Chris.
How does the body respond to trauma?
Well, there are two basic ways that our bodies respond to trauma, and they're both perfectly natural, and they're both life-saving mechanisms, and the problem comes when they go on long after the trauma is over, or we're in situations which continually evoke them. The first one is fight or flight, and this is a response that's there in all vertebrae. It was identified about 100 years ago by Walter Bradford Cannon, who was a world-renowned physiologist. And he observed that when animals or humans were threatened by a predator, they had a series of predictable reactions. Blood pressure went up, heart rate went up, muscles, the big muscles, the ones that you need to run or the ones that you need to fight with, got tense, and digestion started working poorly because if you're being chased by a predator, it is no time to stop for a snack. More recently, we've discovered that when you're in fight or flight, that there's continual heightened activity in a part of the emotional brain called the amygdala, A-M-Y-G-D-A-L-A, which is responsible for fear and anger, and that parts of the frontal part of our cerebral cortex shut down, parts that are responsible for self-awareness, judgment, good decision-making, and compassion. So when we're in fight or flight, which we need if our life is in danger, those are the reactions that happen. And for animals, fight or flight comes very quickly and goes quickly. So for example, many of our listeners have probably seen nature films where, for example, on the Serengeti Plain in Africa, a gazelle is happily grazing, and a lion shows up, and the gazelle goes into fight or flight, and she's off and running as fast as she can. And because she knows, I mean, gazelles are not terribly intelligent, as far as we know, but they know enough to know if it's a question of fight or flight, when a lion shows up, they got to run. Mm. If they're not caught, if the gazelle's not caught by the lion, 2 or 3 minutes later, she's happily grazing. Fight or flight has come, it's done its job, it's gone. The big muscles are relaxing, heart rate's coming down, blood pressure's coming down, and digestion is once again working quite well. So that's fight or flight. That's basic biological reaction that happens when we're threatened. And in human beings, the threat can be an emotional threat, for example, of an abusive relationship or a difficult boss, as well as an actual threat to our physical being. The second major reaction that happens is what's known as the freeze response. And this is when fight or flight is not adequate and it can't work well. In situations where we're feeling both overwhelmed and the situation seems inescapable. So for example, this is what happens to children who are seriously abused or neglected by their parents. They're dependent on these people who are neglecting and abusing them, but they can't get out of the situation. It's what happens when we're assaulted by people who are much bigger than we are as adults, when we're raped, or when we're in a situation like a war or a climate-related disaster where we can't do very much and we can't escape. What happens with freeze is that a part of our brain, deep in the brainstem, is activated. This is part of the parasympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system is fight or flight. The oldest part of the parasympathetic nervous system is the freeze response. We shut down, we may collapse, we may feel numb, we may look limp. We detach ourselves from the situation. We put out lots of endorphins to protect us against the pain. And when fight or flight is really serious, we may feel completely detached from our bodies. Once again, in an animal, the freeze response is and can be life-saving. It can come quickly and go quickly. And if you think about your pet cat, I don't know if you have a cat, but some listeners may have cats. I used to have several cats when I lived in the country, and they would catch mice. And the mice, you'd see the cat with the mouse in her jaw, and the mouse would be limp. She'd just be kind of, you know, falling out of the jaw and just there. And sometimes the cat, of course, would crunch down and kill the poor mouse. Other times the cat would get bored because it's not much fun to play with a limp mouse. So she'd put the mouse down. Mousie would shake himself off, and he'd run off to his mouse hole. He was in a freeze response. It did its job. It saved him while the cat had him in its jaws. And then once the cat put him down, he was able to come back to himself, to restore biological balance, and to escape. With we humans, the freeze response, like the fight or flight response, can go on long after the trauma is over. And we see this often in people who've been abused as children, seriously abused, people who've been raped or assaulted as adults. We see this in a lot of our returning vets, that they're shut down. They're emotionally unavailable. They just feel like they're not quite there. And often enough, the consequences of both fight or flight and freeze, the prolongation of those responses, exist side by side. So at sometimes, and I've experienced this, and I'm sure many of our listeners have, we feel anxious, agitated, can't sleep, can't focus. And at other times, we just feel like, I can't deal with anything. I can't connect with anybody. I just want to be by myself. So those are the basic biological consequences of trauma and the psychological states that they produce when they're prolonged, as they so often are in we humans.
Do we get stuck as humans because our brains allow us to remember the past, to think what we could have done instead of getting ourselves into trouble? Why does it stick with us in a way that it doesn't appear to in animals who are traumatized?
Exactly. I mean, there are many blessings of having a big brain. We have a full range of emotional responses. We can connect with each other and be, you know, do a variety of altruistic acts. We can think logically. We can come up with new concepts. We can use our imagination. And all those are enlisted at times and damaged when we are traumatized. So, for example, our imagination doesn't work so well. And we replay the image of what happened to us over and over with parts of our emotional brain. So we may replay the image of an assault or a rape continually. And we have lots of capacity for association in our brain. So, for example, if we were assaulted on a dark street, we may have the same fear and the same image when we venture into dark streets that are nowhere near the one in which we were assaulted, because it's as if we're going back there. So yes, it's our large brain that is the culprit, in a sense, in terms of prolonging fight or flight and freeze response. And it's also our brain that can help us move through and beyond and these responses and resolve the imbalance.
My guest is Dr. James S. Gordon. He's founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and clinical professor at Georgetown Medical School. His book is called The Transformation: Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. James S. Gordon, founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and author of The Transformation: Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Jim, you have developed a number of really interesting methods that can help people. Start us out by explaining soft belly breathing.
Sure, that's the one to begin with. It's actually what I've been doing here, you know, while the music has been on and while you've been doing the fundraising. Mm. So it's simply breathing slowly and deeply in through the nose and out through the mouth with our belly soft and relaxed, perhaps saying soft as we breathe in and belly as we breathe out, paying attention to the breath, concentrating on the breath, on the words soft and belly, and on the feeling of relaxation in our belly. This is technically a concentrative meditation because we're concentrating on the breath, the words, and the feeling in our belly. It is the antidote to the fight or flight response. It lowers blood pressure, slows heart rate, relaxes the big muscles that are tensed in fight or flight. It improves digestion, quiets activity in the amygdala, the part of the emotional brain responsible for fear and anger, and brings back online all those areas of the frontal cortex that are responsible for good judgment and self-awareness and compassion, and it helps us connect with other people. So it is absolutely basic. It is so simple. It works deeply and effectively on our biology. Anybody can do it. You don't have to pay money for it. You don't have to change your religion or change your clothes or go anywhere special. You can just do it. And the research is very, very convincing that the results are not only the physiological results that I've described, but that there are significant improvements in mood, decreases in anxiety, greater ability to sleep, to focus, to concentrate, more comfort connecting with other people, as well as improved immune functioning. All these different aspects of our physiology and our psychology can be repaired simply by breathing slowly and deeply like this. So it's the technique that I teach right at the beginning of the transformation. It's the one we do when we're working with people in the middle of wars or just after a climate-related disaster. And even in those situations, about 80% of people are able to notice some kind of change. The very first time we do it for 10 or 12 minutes, they feel more relaxed. The room seems a little brighter. Their shoulders are a little less tense. They can focus a little bit better. They feel more kindly disposed to other people. So not only are there those specific benefits, but the message, and this is crucially important when we've experienced trauma or been going through a really difficult, stressful time, the message that we get is we can do something to help ourselves. This is critically important because when we've been traumatized, we often feel helpless and hopeless. And simply doing soft belly breathing, producing some kind of change, lets us know that it is possible for change to happen and that we can do it. We're not helpless and we're not hopeless. And that helps to open the door and provide the foundation for all the other techniques, all the other trauma healing techniques that I teach in the transformation. And for those people, there are some people who won't notice a change in the beginning. Sometimes if you're really tense, you need to do something physical and active to get rid of the tension and then sit quietly. When I first started doing meditation more than 50 years ago, I really couldn't sit still very much at all. So I would do something active and then I would sit still. And so it's a fundamental technique. It's very easy to do. Anybody can do it. And if it doesn't work the first time, then it's likely to work the second or third time.
All right. What is shaking and dancing, since you mentioned being active and not sitting still?
Shaking and dancing is beautiful. Sometimes people feel a little self-conscious about it. It's the idea, if we think about what's going on with fight or flight, you know, we're in a very tense state. Our muscles are tight as if we've got to run away or we got to fight someone. And if we think about the freeze, then we're really shut down. Our emotions are shut down. Our body feels like it's kind of collapsed. Fight or flight breaks up these fixed physical patterns. Shaking and dancing breaks up these fixed physical patterns, and it breaks up the fixed emotions that also accompany trauma. And what it is, again, very simple to do. You stand up, you put your feet shoulder width, you bend your knees a bit, and you begin shaking from your feet up through your knees, hips, chest, shoulders, let your head go. Do that for about 5 or 6 minutes. And what happens in those 5 or 6 minutes is people, they feel a little more energy, they feel a little more relaxed. Emotions may come up that they've suppressed. Then I suggest that everyone stand for a couple of minutes and just relax and be aware of the breath and the body. And then allow your body to move to music that's inspiring and energizing to you. This is probably, this is an expressive meditation. There are three kinds of meditation. Soft belly is one of many concentrative meditations. You can focus on an image, on a sound. Mantra, Sanskrit word for sound, mantra meditations are concentrative meditations. So are repetitive prayers like Our Father or Shema Yisrael or Ilalahu Ilalah. Then there's mindfulness meditation, becoming aware of thoughts, feelings, and sensations as they arise. And then there are expressive meditations like shaking and dancing. These are the oldest ones on the planet. They make use of our body and movement, and they are, as the word sounds, they're expressive. We're expressing with our body. Maybe we're expressing with sounds. This is enormously important in helping to free us from the consequences of trauma. And unfortunately, these expressive meditations are not very well known in our sort of modern Western world, and they're not often used. For trauma, along with soft belly, they are the most important, they are fundamental. They bring us back into psychological as well as physiological balance. And I've seen one with both of these, both with soft belly and with shaking and dancing, just one episode, one attempt, one actual commitment to doing either of these, 5 minutes or 10 minutes of soft belly breathing, 10 minutes of shaking and dancing. I've seen those as the beginning of profound and lasting trauma healing, because it starts to break up that fixed place where we're just shut down and we're so beleaguered by fight or flight and we're so frozen and isolated. And both of these techniques work both separately and together to create the foundation for profound programs of trauma healing. And again, they're very easy to do, and anyone of any age can do them. With shaking and dancing, we've done this with people in wheelchairs and people in hospital beds, as well as people who can stand up.
When do you recommend the technique you call chaotic breathing?
Chaotic breathing is another expressive meditation. You have to imagine a bird that's doing its best to take off. Maybe a chicken. You know how I don't know if you've seen chickens recently. They really flap their wings so energetically and just wildly, and they don't get very far in terms of taking off. But it's that kind of very fast, deep breathing that is chaotic breathing. It's breathing in and out through the nose. This is really important. If you breathe through your mouth, you may hyperventilate. If you breathe in and out through the nose, you will not hyperventilate. The chaotic breathing is extremely useful for, again, it's an expressive meditation. It's a technique that's been used by Tibetans over centuries. It's been used in many other cultures. It is, once again, a way of breaking up fixed physical and emotional patterns, of energizing our body. Now, the thing with chaotic breathing that's really important, and I give complete descriptions of soft belly, of shaking and dancing, and of chaotic breathing and the transformation, as well as of all the other techniques. With soft belly and shaking and dancing, there are really no contraindications. with chaotic breathing, if you're going to use all those muscles, your shoulder muscles, raising your arms up and down like wings to push the breath in and out like a bellows or the chicken taking off, most people can do it. However, if your shoulder dislocates easily, if you have very high blood pressure, if you've recently had a heart attack, if you have metastases or significant injury to your spine, especially your upper spine, or if you're pregnant, you should not do all that extra wing flapping. Just do the breathing. Listeners can hear me. Just do the breathing in and out through your nose without all that extra physical motion. And again, the first stage is doing that fast, deep breathing. And then there's a pause to just relax and be aware. And then put on music that allows you to express yourself. The idea of the sequence is to break up the fixed patterns that come after trauma to become a bit more observant and appreciative of the breath and body, and then to have some time to express what we've shut down in trauma. We shut off our emotions. We close our body down. We protect ourselves. So the first phase, whether it's shaking and dancing or the fast, deep breathing, opens us up. Then we become a little more relaxed and observant. And then when we put on music that's inspiring for us, then our bodies can move in the way they want to move. And everybody's going to move differently. This is not about doing any particular kind of dance. Now, I started doing chaotic breathing, this is 45 years ago, when I asked the man who was a major teacher for me, Sham Singha, who was from Kashmir. He was an acupuncturist, herbalist, meditation master. I asked him a little bit anxiously what kind of meditation I should do. And he said, you remember the chaotic breathing? And I thought, oh my God. I said, yes, how can I forget? He said, do it 40 minutes a day.
Wow.
And I thought I'd misheard him. I said, are you serious? He said, baby, I am serious. So I did it for 40 minutes a day. And I did it every day, no matter what, no matter where. I was a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health at the time, and I was traveling around the country, and I would do it no matter where I was, sometimes to the amusement of my hosts, if I was staying in people's homes. And what it did for me is it helped to break up some of those fixed ideas I had about myself and my profession and how I should act. It helped me to move through fears that I didn't even know I had. Fears of what might happen to my body, for example. I would have a pain in my chest and I'd think, oh, I'm having a heart attack. I wasn't having a heart attack. I was 35 years old and I was in pretty good health. But I'd go through that fear. So it was an amazing experience for me. And as I continued to do it, I felt so much lighter. I felt so much easier in the world. Had much more energy. I was much less irritated, impatient, and fearful than I had been before. So it was a very deep education. Now, I don't recommend 40 minutes a day for just about anybody. I was, maybe I'm a particularly thick-headed person. But I was experimenting, was really very open to it. If you do it for 5 or 6 minutes, you'll get a significant benefit. All these are experiments. The thing that's important also is that nobody likes every technique. And sometimes, it's very surprising which technique people like. So, for example, I was in, we were working in Haiti after the earthquake.
You know what, Jim, I definitely want to hear the story, and I need to take a quick break right now, and I want to make sure that you have time to tell it. So let me put a pause on that. We'll make sure and talk about Haiti after the earthquake, because I'd love to hear about that work. My guest is Dr. James S. Gordon, founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, clinical professor at Georgetown Medical School, and author of a new book called The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, Dr. James S. Gordon, whose new book is The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Jim, you mentioned you went to Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. This was a disaster, many people will recall. The death toll was well over 100,000 people. I mean, everywhere you turn, people were traumatized. So how could you help them?
Well, first of all, I want to come back to that in a moment. You mentioned something about the book, which I wanted to agree with and emphasize. This really is a book for everyone. That's why I wrote the book. Trauma of one kind or another, challenges in our lives, are going to come to all of us. And the transformation is really about living our life fully, meeting the challenges successfully, and becoming who we're meant to be. So I just wanted to emphasize that. And a lot of the work that I've done and a lot of what I've learned has been with whole populations that have been terribly traumatized, as well as with sort of ordinary Americans like me dealing with the stresses and challenges of our own lives. In Haiti, after the earthquake, the whole society was turned upside down, and hundreds of thousands of people lost their homes. Nobody even really knows what the death toll is. You mentioned 100,000, it might have been 200, it might have been 300,000. We really still don't know. So many, we worked training, this is the Center for Mind-Body Medicine, teaching people in Haiti the same techniques, the same ways of working, the same approaches, the same optimistic and yet evidence-based way of moving through trauma, of creating transformation. We taught people in Haiti that method, just as we have many other places around the world and here in the United States. I think now we've trained close to 7,000 health professionals, mental health professionals, educators, leaders of women's groups, other community leaders, religious leaders. What I was thinking of in Haiti is one of the 250 people whom we trained and continue to provide supervision and guidance to was a priest named Father Freddy. And Father Freddy was in charge of a tent camp where there were kids who'd lost their parents who were living in this camp. And there were a couple hundred kids in the camp. And Father Freddy was doing mind-body skills groups. He was teaching the kids soft belly breathing and shaking and dancing and doing drawings and teaching the kids to use their imagination and appreciate nature more, the whole program that's in the transformation. And I was down there and talking with some of the kids who had been in the groups that Father Freddy was running. And I said to this little 8-year-old boy, I said, what was your favorite technique in the mind-body group? And usually the kids will say, oh, I like the soft belly breathing, or the shaking and dancing was fun, or the drawings. I learned so much from the drawings and they were good. He looked at me and he said, the chaotic breathing. And then he went, I said, really? Because it's not easy to do. I said, well, why did you like that so much? He said, well, in the earthquake, when the earthquake came, and this was now almost 2 years after the earthquake, when the earthquake came, our house collapsed and my mother was trapped underneath the house and I watched her die.
Oh.
And that image of my mother dying and how horrible and how painful that was to me, that was with me all the time after the earthquake, for more than a year after the earthquake. And I had it all during the day, it would come back to me. And I couldn't sleep at night because when I closed my eyes, that's what I would see. I would see my mother just trying to breathe and not being able to. And then I would see her in my dreams and I couldn't sleep and I'd wake up and I hated sleeping. He said, once I began to, and then he went, once I began to do that breathing, he said, I started to do it. And I started to be able to go to sleep. And I started to be able to sleep through the night and to feel comfortable and to feel rested in the morning. He said, and so that's why I like the chaotic breathing. I said, great. Now, I could never have predicted that. I think one of the things about we humans, which is pretty obvious, but we sometimes forget, is that we're all unique and that different forms of healing, different techniques, different tools are appeal to different people. And I think one of the crucial things, and these children who remind me of it, and so adults do as well, when they tell me, when I ask this question, what did you like best and why? And it's amazing how different we are and how all of us can find tools and techniques to use that can make a difference for us. So what I've done in the transformation is to describe and provide the evidence for and tell inspiring stories about 20 or 25 different approaches and techniques, and to give people the opportunity to experiment, to see which ones work best for them and how to best put them together in a program that meets their needs.
One of the other techniques you recommend is asking people to draw things on paper, three separate images in which they are featured, and you say the third drawing is often revelatory. So what are those drawings of, and what is special about the last one?
Well, the drawings, the first set of drawings, we use a couple different sets of drawings. The first set that we use and that I suggest in the transformation to do with the beginning of our work together, because I'm really working with you as you read the book, I hope people will feel that and see it, is to draw yourself. Draw yourself with your biggest problem, and draw yourself with your problem solved. So this begins to help us get out of this rational, ruminating mind where we're worried about this and making lists and trying to figure things out, and become a little more imaginative, a little more playful, maybe a little bit more childlike. So the first drawing tells us a lot about how we see ourselves. And the second drawing, the one of drawing ourselves with our biggest problem, we identify what a problem is, and it comes out. And sometimes it's very surprising. Sometimes the problem we think is going to be there is not the one that's there at all. So, for example, I remember a number of people whom I've worked with cancer, and you expect the second drawing to be about the cancer, and it sometimes isn't. One woman, for example, she had ovarian cancer, and when she drew her biggest problem, it was a red blob, a fiery red blob in her belly. And I sort of was thinking and assuming it was the cancer. And she said, no, this is my anger at my husband. That's my biggest problem.
Huh.
And the solution to her problem, she drew herself sitting opposite her husband and talking to him, telling him why she was so angry, which she hadn't done in a long, long time, or maybe ever. So she got the message. And, you know, from the outside, we have all kinds of preconceptions. Well, maybe if she's going to do the drawing, she'll draw cancer treatment and then a better form of cancer treatment. No, that sometimes happens, but that's not what happened for her. So the third drawing is often revelatory. I was just in an Appalachian county not so long, a few days ago, where they've had a terrible opioid epidemic. And there was a young guy whose brother had died of an overdose. And he did the drawings. And in his second drawing, again, you might have expected, well, he would draw his sorrow. Maybe he would draw his losing his brother. But no, what he drew is a bunch of fists and a kind of vague face behind it. And he said, this is, when I asked him afterwards, what is it? I'm not interpreting or analyzing. And people don't need that. They can make the discoveries themselves. He said, this is my anger. When I was a teenager, I was so angry all the time. I was getting in fights all the time. He said, no, now I'm a grown-up and I have kids, but that anger's still inside me. And then the third drawing, he drew this wonderful scene of mountains and a kind of beautiful the horizon stretching beyond. And he said, this is the solution. I need to spend more time in nature. This is where I come to myself, where I find peace and quiet. So the drawings are opening us to our imagination. And once we've done a little bit of soft belly and some shaking and dancing, and once our physiology is a little bit more balanced, then our imagination can be much more effective and give us very clear direction about what we need to do to help and heal ourselves.
Dr. James S. Gordon is founder and executive director of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine and clinical professor at Georgetown Medical School. His new book is The Transformation, Discovering Wholeness and Healing After Trauma. Jim, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.